Welcome to Truth Nation. Chief Mark Garrett, good to see you.
Good to see you, my friend. How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well, man. Today is, this is the Zodiac calling, or speaking. That was his thing, right? This is the Zodiac speaking. The story of the serial killer, the Zodiac, several crimes, several murders and attempted murders in California over the course of, I guess it turns out to be 10 years or so. No one ever charged with the crimes. There is some consensus, I guess is the best way, at least the best way I think to phrase it, some consensus as to who the perpetrator is, was, who the suspect was. But like I said, no one ever charged. And there's people that really disagree strongly with this, who this suspect is. Everybody has their own theories. There's even disagreement out there as to which crimes are actually attributable to the Zodiac and which are not. My interest in this comes from, and I think probably similar to you, a recent documentary that Netflix just released, three-part show. And this is, the Zodiac case is something that's really intrigued, I don't know what you call it, armchair investigators over the years. And as I said, number one, because no one's been charged. Number two, because the Zodiac killer taunted police. And that's something that not... Yeah, this is, okay, so this is, thank you, Vince. This is the Zodiac speaking is the name of it.
Yep.
The Zodiac killer taunted the police. He wrote letters to the media, letters to police departments. He wrote coded letters about who his next victims were going to be. And we'll get into some of that stuff, all of that stuff. But I think, Mark, when I watch this show, it always comes back to, I guess you've had an impact on me. Let me put it that way. Some of the things you say have an impact on me, and I remember them. And when we talked about O.J. Simpson, the O.J. Simpson case, and I was making a big deal about the circumstantial evidence attributable to O.J., or, you know, that case relied heavily on circumstantial evidence. And you said something to the effect that, Bill, a lot of the people in prison for murder right now are there because of circumstantial evidence. That's what the evidence is in murder cases, or something to that effect, Mark. Mm-hmm. And boy, that is, with the Zodiac case, it's a lot of circumstantial evidence. We're talking about crimes that happened in the 60s and early 70s. So there's no DNA. There's no tracking of cell phones to determine someone's whereabouts. Circumstantial evidence is a huge part of this, and that's probably why no one was ever charged. The second thing, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, Mark, the second thing that I feel in cases like this, which makes it hard to prosecute them, a murder case like this, is the randomness of it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times investigators will rely on a motive to put the case together. The OJ case, we know OJ had a relationship with Nicole Brown Simpson, right? And we know the reasons why he was, the anger he had about the failed relationship. But in a case where it's totally random, it's very hard for investigators to pinpoint someone and kind of develop a suspect based on who someone knows. So I think that's another thing in this case, in serial cases like this that are random, that makes it difficult. Do you agree with that? That the randomness of it has an impact?
I do, Bill. You know, any murder case is very likely to involve someone who knew the victim. That's just the numbers. It's irrefutable. I don't know what the actual percentages are, you know, 85-90%,
but I've heard close to 90. Yeah, 90%,
about 90%. And of the time that the perpetrator knew the victim or victims very well. And when you look at any serial murder case, this goes to the point that you're making, that it makes it very, very difficult to at least initially narrow that field of suspects, because by definition, there's no pipeline. There are no you know, bumpers to take you in a certain direction from the beginning. When you look at any number of serial killers. So it doesn't give you any initial kind of jumping off point to get started with the investigation. And then on top of that, when you're talking about a single murder, in one jurisdiction, you can concentrate resources, concentrate forces, concentrate your interviews of witnesses. But when these happen throughout different jurisdictions mm-hmm. and then different geographic times over large time spans, boy, does it make it very, very difficult. You know, similarly, we did an episode recently on the Night Stalker, you know, predominantly in Southern California. You know, another one similar, it really was in a lot of ways similar to the Zodiac killings. Really only got solved because of some fantastic detective work and some lucky breaks.
Right. And you know, that's great that you brought that up, Mark. So what we're talking, the Night Stalker was what, late 80s, if I'm remembering right, Mark?
Yes, it was a mid to late 80s.
So 20 years after the Zodiac and the changes in this is a great point you brought up, because as I watched the Zodiac documentary, I thought silos, right? Mm-hmm. Different police departments just with siloed information, not even knowing there was related crimes or potentially related crimes until maybe, believe it or not, they saw it in the news and mm-hmm. thought, ooh, that's kind of related to something we're doing. So that for sure, I think, had an effect in the 60s and early 70s on crime fighting. Just a lack of interoperability and a lack of communication between different state law enforcement agencies, especially as the geographic area gets bigger, as you said. Like if it's two neighboring towns, yeah, they're going to have personal relationships and be more comfortable and more used to solving crimes together. When you start talking Northern California to Southern California, back to Central California to New York, then all of a sudden it's a lot more difficult at that time to coordinate and work it. The family, I think probably first, Mark, let's talk a little bit about the family, because we'll be using the names of these people. And I think it's significant for people to understand who they are and how this family developed a relationship with the person who, I think it's fair to say, they now believe was a Zodiac killer, right?
Yes.
The Seawater family. Mm-hmm. A mom with 6 or 7 kids. Do you remember which it was? I was confused whether she had 6 kids and was pregnant or had just given birth to a 7th child.
I think it was 6 kids, but I was, it's so funny you bring that up. I want you to clarify for me. I was a little bit confused too, but I think it was a total of 6.
Yeah. So 6 kids. A father not present.
Yes.
Right? And why was the father not present, Mark? Do you remember or to get the discussion on that?
No, I've forgotten why he was.
Yeah, he was convicted of molestation.
Oh.
Of molesting.
Isn't that funny? So actually, I told you I watched this a few weeks ago and I forgot that detail.
but that I think probably goes to this how. Well, so the mom's name is Phyllis Seawater. Mm-hmm. And really the two kids that we're going to talk about the most, 2 of the 6 kids, Connie Seawater and David Seawater, they were the ones that were most involved with this person who turned out to be the Zodiac suspect. And his name was Arthur Lee Allen. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time the relationship developed between Arthur Allen and the family, Arthur was a grade school teacher. Is that right?
And
so I don't know whether he probably, at least I would think a school teacher would be somewhat familiar with the home life of these kids, knew it was a big family, potentially knew the father wasn't present, and, you know, almost maybe started grooming the children of this family and started up a relationship with the family. Now, what was this relationship, Mark? They traveled a bunch. He was over the house, right? So he kind of, would you say he kind of just interjected himself as a father figure into their lives?
Yeah, I would. When you watch the documentary, and this is one of the things that it's part of the puzzle, talking about circumstantial evidence. Mm-hmm. And you use the word grooming, Bill, and I think that's exactly right. Let's separate the possibility or likelihood that this man was the Zodiac killer. Let's put that in a different place for right now, and just look at the relationship between his students and their mother. I think when you look at the process that he engaged in, it really is the definition of grooming. One of the reasons is initially it appeared, at least in the documentary, and we have to take everything with a grain of salt when you're watching a documentary, although I think this is excellent, it appears that his initial affections or attention was really directed at the mother initially in this documentary, mm-hmm. which I think is, in other words, it's another sign ultimately of grooming. Mm-hmm. If we find out that his intentions were ultimately with the kids, because you want to make her comfortable. You want her to make her feel that you're trustworthy. And then once you win her over, now you have an open pathway to engage in whatever relationship you want to with the children. And I thought about that when I was watching it, because I was assuming right away that it was just going to be about him and maybe molest the children, things like that. But initially, he really worked on developing a relationship with the mother, making her feel comfortable, making her probably feel, you know, some level of romance. And then it changed from that point. So the reason I say separate those two is because when you separate, you know, his grooming of the children to the possibility of being the Zodiac Killer, you want to evaluate each part of it separately, because it gives more credibility if he's engaging in one nefarious act after the other. And that's what I think I saw in this documentary.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Mark. That's a good point. And he knew probably, most likely, or definitely, really, that she was vulnerable, right? Yes. Because the husband, or it's never really clear if it's a husband or, I don't know, father of the children, was in the mental hospital charged with molestation.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And now I remember vividly now when you talked about, I think it was a Tascadero.
Yep.
Yes. And so it all came back to me right now about the father. And you talk about irony.
That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah. And also, listen, whenever we talk about a documentary, and I've said this before, you do have to be cognizant that you're getting a narrative of one point of view. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there is people online out there that disagree with this gentleman as a suspect, that think Arthur Allen should be excluded. But man, when you hear of all the quote coincidences or mm-hmm. whatever that we're going to talk about, you really have to think that, you know, likely that was the guy. What else about the family, Mark, before we get into some of the crimes? Anything? I mean,
not at this point. There's a lot about the family, and there's a lot about ancillary kind of testimony or so in the documentary. But I think at this point we kind of move forward. But there are a lot of bits and pieces in there that I find compelling.
Mm-hmm. And the only thing I would add, I guess, is that the kids really liked Arthur Lee Allen. They really liked him. They liked spending time with him. He took them to do fun stuff. Yes. He was like an avid swimmer or diver. He would take him to the beach. He had an Austin Healey convertible. He would drive him around in a convertible. He kind of did things with him. And, you know, hey, I feel like the mom probably liked that too, because it just gave her a break probably from, you know, a house with six kids in it, right?
Yes, yeah. And then what are the things you touched on there about being an avid diver? I mean, people talked about his very ungainly, I guess, physique. Mm-hmm. He was a large man, you know, kind of shapeless, things like this. But they said when he got on a diving board, he looked like an Olympic diver. He was, you know, a tremendous diver, and he loved the water. And of course, the water has a nexus to a number of these murders throughout the state of California, which is another compelling, you know, coincidence.
Right.
But yeah, as far as being adventurous and taking these kids on these, you know, these wonderful outings, the kids absolutely loved them. As a matter of fact, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but they loved them to the point that, according to what they see in the documentary, they did not want to believe it could have possibly been him until they saw some of the evidence.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was almost like an awakening when, I guess we'll get to that, you know, in 2017, when a different movie came out about the Zodiac Killer, and they went and saw it, and they had like this awakening, like, wait a minute. That kind of coincides with a lot of things that were happening in our life. Mm-hmm. The first murders that this documentary talks about, the first Zodiac murders were in December 1968, December 20th, 1968. And I guess the town was Benicia, or I don't know if that's a town or like an isolated area, but generally these crimes reminded me a little bit of the Son of Sam crimes 10 years later, where it was like Lover's Lane type of thing. Mm-hmm. The killer would find isolated areas with vehicles parked and just go up and assassinate the occupants. And December 20th, 68, it was Betty Lou Jensen, a 16-year-old, and David Faraday, a 17-year-old, both shot, I think, right in the car and killed.
Yeah, I think both shot in the car, and I believe it was one of them actually got out of the car, was running after they had been shot initially, and then shot, I think, point blank on the ground, if I remember correctly, Bill. But
Right. I think it was David was shot in the head outside the car, right?
Yes. He had been shot initially in the car. I believe it got shot in the knee or leg or something like that, but then got out and the killer caught him and shot him in the head on the ground.
And at that time, the investigators believed the teenagers were, you know, randomly targeted, which goes to what you're saying. Like, how do you, at that time when there's no DNA evidence, it's very difficult. There's no cell phones, anything like that, and no technology. It's very difficult to solve such a random crime like that.
To start placing a suspect at the scene. And of course, right. By the way, this area where these teenagers were shot and killed was a, you know, kind of a known Lover's Lane kind of place. It was very desolate. It was a long, small road off of more of a main highway. And so for someone, like a murderer who wanted to take advantage of a secreted location, it was probably something that they were aware of, the killer was aware of.
Yeah, the next one was like 6 or 7 months later it was 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And again, it was like another Lover's Lane type thing. It was a car at a golf course at night, young man and woman. The woman was shot multiple times. The guy was shot multiple times. I think the guy survived the shooting on that one, Mark. Does that sound right?
No, I don't believe he survived.
Okay.
That one. We'll talk about another one coming up where the man did survive, but I could be wrong on that one.
This was the one in Vallejo.
Yep.
The interesting thing about this is he calls the Vallejo, or somebody calls the Vallejo Police Department and claimed responsibility for the shooting, as well as the previous murders back in December. That was Lake Herman Road, I guess. He said, "I want to report a murder." He called the Vallejo Police Department and said he wanted to report a murder and told the police exactly where to go. And he said, "Hey, you'll find kids in a brown car. Here's the type of gun they were shot with." And he said, "I also killed those kids last year." And, you know, assuming that this was the one in December, the previous year, 1968. Again, no suspects, right? The police have no suspects at that time. This is when the letters start coming. You know, had you ever been involved in any kind of criminal case where there was like almost like a taunting of police like that? Or I don't know. I mean, I guess as a profile, it really.
And by the way,
do you feel like,
go ahead. Bill, the male did survive that shooting. You're absolutely
okay.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Go ahead. Uh-huh.
No, I was saying, do you feel like, and this is getting into, we're not psychologists, Mark. I get it. Right. But when someone is calling up the police and telling them, you know, "I just did this murder here," and then he's writing letters and, you know, boasting about the crimes, do you feel like that's some kind of subconscious urge that he wants to get caught, that he wants to be stopped, that it's not controllable? And he's almost like, or is it just ego? You know, he thinks he's so much smarter than everyone else that there's really... He feels like he's toying with the police and it's entertainment for him? Or is it
it's a good question. Like I said, we're not shrinks. I probably need one sometimes, but I'm not one myself. But I don't know. I think, you know, my guess is the ultimate layperson in this, Bill, my guess would be that it actually adds more excitement to the entire process for the killer. That's my guess. This whole thing about, it's kind of really an underlying, you know, desire to actually get caught. Maybe that's true. But if I had to roll the dice, this simply enhances the excitement, the thrill of the kill, that they can taunt, you know, law enforcement and the public and the media and to paying more attention to them, to walking that fine edge, you know, to sneaking into someone's house without being caught. It's not just the murder itself. It is the infiltration of someone's domicile. It's all through. And by the way, there was part of that. We talked about that again with the Night Stalker. That was part of the thrill for him. Mm-hmm. So that would be my guess. This just kind of enhances the deviant evil pleasure these people experience when they do stuff like this as far as taunting the authorities.
Yeah, you know, and I do remember that now, that Gil Carrillo, the sheriff homicide investigator on the Night Stalker case, he talked about the deviancy where the killer would get the person's attention before killing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to see the look of surprise and to see the look of shock. And at least in this last murder we just talked about in the golf course, he shined a light in the car first, mm-hmm. and there was some speculation or whatever that he told them to get out of the car. But whatever, he definitely didn't just walk up and execute them without them being aware of what was about to happen.
And we'll see more of this, I think, in the subsequent murder and murders. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. The thing that struck me most about this killing was the letters, right? These are the letter that he wrote to, let's see, he wrote a letter to the San Francisco Examiner later that month of July. And I think there was a couple other letters too that he wrote, probably to the police department, et cetera. And the chief, and I don't know, I think it was the chief of the Vallejo Police Department, publicly expressed skepticism that the letters had been written by the killer. Now, I don't know. At first, I thought, man, that's a weird thing to do. But there may have been a method to that madness where the law enforcement did actually believe he had written the letter. But by now kind of taunting him, they were going to get him to give them more information and further incriminate himself. Because the chief said something to the effect, like, I'd like to hear if I don't think it's the killer that wrote these letters. I'd like to get something else from him to prove that he's the guy. You know, something like that, Mark. And a couple days later, August 4th, so like 4 days after the other first letters were written, he did send another letter which had more specifics in it. And that was the first time he used the name the Zodiac, mm-hmm. right? And said, yes. I'm the Zodiac. September 27th. So now we're going, a couple months later? Really just a month, 2 months later now?
Yeah, 2 months
and
later, actually.
This is Lake Berryessa. Again, you know, this one had some strange parts to it. The first is the costume, right? And this one, if I don't know, Mark, do you know if this one was in day? I think this one was in daylight.
It was in broad daylight. Broad
daylight. That is crazy.
Yeah.
Do you remember the costume the guy had on? Didn't he
have
some kind of
like... And again, this ties in with the circumstantial evidence, you know, from the recollection of the seawater children later on. But yes, I mean, he's wearing this, you know, apparently described by the survivor. This is the second person who survived an attack, the male of this couple. But he's wearing this he's fully cloaked in a black, he's called a robe or something like that, you know, kind of a full body thing in a black hood. And in part of that costume, he had the Zodiac sign, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think it was on the actual torso.
Yep, right on his chest or something, right, or below his chin.
Yeah, so they couldn't see any part of his face. It's in a black hood or cylindrical kind of, you know, hood, things like this. But yeah, broad daylight. And then of course, being in something so conspicuous as this, but again, in a place known for, you know, kind of a lover's lane kind of place, very isolated and, you know, sparsely kind of populated. I think probably maybe even especially in the daytime, maybe it's more populated at night, but yeah.
What I thought was most interesting about this one, or some key points in this, he had a gun with him, but didn't use it. The murder weapon was a knife, and he kind of just walked up to him. I don't know. He got them to cooperate to the extent that they allowed him to tie them up. Yes. And he had these kind of pre-cut lengths of rope with him, and then just went to town stabbing them. Like you said, the guy survived. But here's what he did that's, well, the whole thing is crazy, but here's what he did that's especially crazy. He knew what vehicle they arrived in. And he went to that vehicle, and I don't know if it was parked next to a little access road that runs around the lake or what it was, but he went to that vehicle and he wrote on the vehicle, Vallejo, 12-20-68. Then he put 7-4-69, and then he put September 27, 1969, the date that day, 6:30 by knife. Yeah. So that was, he was basically saying, you know, I killed these other people on these days, and I just did this one. Here's how I did it. And he put the symbol. Now, I don't know, I guess we're calling it a zodiac symbol, but it's like the circle with the crosshair in it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The circle with the plus sign in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crazy calling card. Now, the hood, you kind of brought up something about this hood. Hey, I heard people describe it as an executioner's hood, right? Mm-hmm. This big kind of droopy hood that he had on with slits where the eyes were. And check me on this, Mark, but I feel like, so we talked about Arthur Lee Allen being an avid waterman. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he did with the kids is they helped him make wetsuits, homemade wetsuits that he would wear when he was out in the water. And he would take neoprene, he would glue it together. And they say that one of the things they helped him make was like this type of hood. I don't know if it was made out of neoprene or exactly what it was made out of, but they do say that they helped him make a hood that looked like this, that could have been in their mind what he was wearing that day. Did you catch that?
Yeah, and that's what I was alluding to earlier about, you know, this outfit. You know, it has a nexus to the memories of the respective children. And again, like you said early at the show, Bill, you talk about circumstantial evidence. You know, there is quite a large quantity of it, and we're just kind of, you know, getting into some of it.
Yeah.
But this, you know, this one thing alone about someone hand making their own, you know, diving gear and out of this particular material, it's black, it's, you know, it's hood like, and, you know, and they witnessed, actually they helped him make it. I believe there was some of this material in the trunk of his car as well. I know that there was some other evidence we'll talk about, but, when you start combining that with these other aspects here, it gets pretty powerful.
And Mark, this was, I think, and maybe Vince or Anthony will check me on this, but this was the murder where Arthur Allen was coincidentally, let's say, stopped by a police officer speeding on a road near that scene.
Yeah.
And there was blood. I don't know if it was on the seat of the car or blood in the car. And they asked him, hey, what is that blood from? Yeah. And he said something like, I just killed a chicken, and that's what the blood is from. Yeah. So this is, Vince is saying this is the one.
Yeah.
So again, Mark, talk about, I don't know, maybe it's how times have changed in law enforcement or things that used to be accepted 40 years ago that wouldn't be today. But if you're stopping someone for speeding and there's blood, and I don't know, I got to think it, you know, speculation on my part, but in order to notice that it's blood, there has to be some amount of it there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You
what's
know,
the, what's I, a patrol I, officer thinking when there's blood in the car? You're writing a speeding ticket and letting, or what's going to happen?
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm surprised a cop ever admitted to such a thing, right? Because that's the only way that we actually know this conversation took place, is because the cop said, you know, I stopped this guy and there's blood in the car. And he explained it away by saying that, you know, he had just killed a chicken. Mm-hmm. What, did you kill a chicken in your car? Was right. Was there so much blood all over you that now there is blood spread out on the passenger seat or in the rear of the vehicle or things like this? It's good. I can sit here, I guess, all day and play Monday morning quarterback about something like that you would see in a traffic stop. But I'll tell you this right now. And I'm so glad you brought this particular element up, Bill, because I would hope that if I had stopped someone under the same circumstance, you stopped them for speeding, whatever traffic violation, and you see that amount of blood in the car, that's one. It's like, radar should go up. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you cut yourself? I don't see you bleeding out of your, you know, hip, things like that. Do you need medical assistance? Are you okay? That'd really be my first inclination. Hey, are you bleeding? Are you okay? But if their answer is, I just killed a chicken. Now, again, I worked in a densely populated city area in Southern California. So the idea that someone would have killed a chicken and they're going down the 210 freeway or the 101 or the 405, that would really, really raise red flags. You go back 50 years, they're in a rural area. Is it more possible? Is that something that maybe officers saw, you know, once every couple of months that someone had blood from, you know, livestock on the car? Maybe. So I want to be fair about it. I don't know the circumstances, but my God, that seems like a, pardon the phrase here, it seems like a pretty, pretty significant red flag if you see blood in a car and the explanations, I killed a chicken. I would get the person out to do a little further investigation.
Yeah, and if there's a search of that car, which, you know, it's probably not that hard to do back in the 60s.
No, exactly.
What would have been found in the trunk of that car? Would there have been sections of rope? Would there have been the costume or whatever we're calling this thing?
By the way, in this case, the knife.
The knife and the gun that he
had. Yes,
and the gun. He did have a gun in his hand. So,
by the way, which would have been tied, apparently, because they were all 22s to the previous murders.
Yep.
Good point. They're all 22 caliber.
Probably this was one of the key points in the story where there was the potential to collect more evidence if Arthur Allen was in fact the killer, and it kind of slipped through law enforcement's hands. One thing that I want to go back to real quick is this letter that the Zodiac killer wrote in late July, early August, about the previous killings, right? Because it contained a cipher. And a code, right? He used these shape. How would you describe that, Mark? Like almost like creating your own alphabet with different shapes and
symbols.
Figures.
Yeah,
symbols.
It really is.
There
just different symbols, and it's almost like an upgraded version of hieroglyphics.
Right.
You know.
So two school teachers cracked this cipher, and you know, what part of the thing, and I don't know if this was the part that was encoded in the letter or this was the part that was just written in the King's English, but he said it was most challenging the most challenging hunt was to hunt a human, and that he was making slaves for the afterlife by killing these people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pretty obviously some mental illness there. But it goes to what you were saying about making the thrill greater by giving some information to the police and creating that excitement that there was the potential that he might get caught. Oh, the San Francisco, I think, right? The October 13th.
Driver.
Yes. Yeah. So less than a month later in San Francisco, a taxi driver is murdered. Mm-hmm. And there's witnesses, right? There's eyewitnesses. They're not, it's nighttime. They're not up close. I think they were looking out the window of their house.
Yep.
Or looking out the window of a nearby building, whatever the case, the taxi driver is killed. The suspect tears a piece of his shirt off. And I don't know, there's like the witness statements are, he was like wiping down the cab with it or using it to wipe the cab. And he leaves with this part of the bloody shirt. Taxi driver's dead. The call goes out that there was just this shooting in the area. And police stop Arthur Allen a couple blocks away on foot. Mm-hmm. And what does he say? Oh, yeah, I saw that. I saw someone over there. He went that way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess it turns out the initial statement that came out, or somehow the word got to the police that it was a black male they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And according to the story now, that's why they didn't take Arthur Lee Allen to be the suspect and asked him, have you seen someone matching this description? And he says, yeah, the guy went that way. But later in letters that he writes, Zodiac letters, he basically says, like, they almost caught me here or something to that effect.
Yeah, exactly. Do I do wonder if the black male thing had to do anything with a possible attire? that he was wearing black outfit,
right,
and things, right, get, you know, lost in translation, you know, who knows, or there might just have been, you know, presidential assumptions made at the time. I don't know what it is, but, you know, the fact is the cop stopped this guy and the suspect, or actually this person says, oh yeah, the person went that way.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of, I get it. Again, I wasn't there. It's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but the, you know, proximity to the killing,
yeah,
you know, can you stop and get a little more information from this person? Where were you? When did you see this person running that way? And how did you see him? And can you give us a description? Where were you 5 minutes ago? There doesn't seem to be any, there doesn't seem to be anybody going kind of the extra mile, at least for these two cases where law enforcement likely had direct contact with the killer.
Right. And had that guy been patted down, I mean, this was,
that's a good point.
Murder excellent by point, guns. Bill. Yeah.
Yes. So excellent point.
And then after this murder, there's, you know, a couple letters, one to the police department, again, one to the, which we haven't really talked about. He was writing a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle a lot. And he puts in this letter, DES, which I guess was an abbreviation for December. He did misspell some things in these letters.
Yeah. Now, that's another important,
yeah,
piece of this. And you can talk about it, yeah, if you want to.
No, but, go ahead.
So it's important because, you know, the Seawater children, you know, who were his students originally, and not just them. This is an important part here. We talk about the children, who are the primary, you know, kind of characters.
Whistleblowers.
Yeah. They're not the only ones. There are people who were not related to the Seawaters. I mean, either literally or in a practical point of view that, you know, were acquainted with them, who spoke in the documentary, who gave supporting kind of, you know, references, recollections, about Allen. But one of the things that was very consistent from a lot of different people is that he would purposely misspell things in correspondence, and he would acknowledge that he misspelled things on purpose. In other words, it was type of a fun thing that he did. He was very obviously intelligent, but he would purposely misspell things. I can't remember exactly what his motivation was, but he acknowledged that he did it on purpose. So when you see a lot of misspelled words in the correspondence to law enforcement and to the media with them, again, it's another piece of the puzzle that points to his behavior. Uh-huh. It's very consistent leading to him.
Hey, the other part of that, which you just made me remember, was, well, first he wrote DES, then July, then August, then September, then October, months that these killings took place.
Mm-hmm.
And then he put equals seven. You know, like this is the number of victims, people I've killed in these months.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we meant, either of us mentioned this yet, but students of his say, and he was a grade school teacher. I don't know if we mentioned that. I think I did.
Yes,
he did. Was a grade school teacher. That one of the exercises he used to do in class is he would give the class ciphers for them to solve.
Right.
So he would give them kind of simple-ish coded passages, and they would have to break the cipher and decode the message. And he was a history teacher, Vince says, a history teacher. So when you see that he, you know, had a love or had an interest in ciphers, also commonly misspelled words on purpose, and you see that happening in these Zodiac letters, again, Mark, circumstantial evidence that that points to him.
Yeah.
And he, you know, in these letters with these things, he would, some of them had pieces of the bloody shirt from the cab driver in it. So there was definitely a legitimate connection. The letter writer was legitimately connected to these crimes.
Yes. Yes. To all of them. I mean, so, in other words, yeah, go ahead, Bill. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is where the documentary then kind of takes a step back. And, you know, we started our discussion of the crimes, I don't know, around, I think, December 1968, mm-hmm, and basically followed it through to October 69.
Yep.
Several murders and attempted murders. Circumstantial evidence. You know, he's blood on the seat. He's getting a speeding ticket nearby. The kids helped him make the hood, or a hood similar to the one he wore in that costume getup. He used to give the kids ciphers, and there were ciphers using the letters. He used to misspell words on purpose, misspell words and letters, all these things.
And by the way, Bill, by the way,
yeah,
he very closely fit the physical description from a number of witnesses that either, you know, the taxi driver or the survivors, the two male survivors from the respective murders. So, mm-hmm. you know, describe him as a tall, large body. So that's, you know, now again, you know, that can cover a huge percentage of the population, but it's another thing that does not exclude him. These are very, very consistent with the description from the suspect of the victims.
Good point. And then also to what you said earlier, and I don't know if I'm off base on this, hey, a large guy, but also very athletic.
Yeah.
To some extent, mm-hmm. you know, when he's able to do, and there was a clip in the documentary of who, I'm assuming it was him, diving off a board.
Yeah.
And doing like, you know, a backflip, landing on the board again, and then a double forward flip into the pool. And this is, like you said, a large man doing this. So when you talk about overpowering somebody or having the ability to overpower someone, and then now here's the part where I don't know if I'm off base. Is it a little bit, when you see kind of like a, I don't know, we'll call him a chubby guy, but is it a less threatening, would that be less threatening to people, Mark, or would it not? Just because he's a big guy, it would be kind of threatening. Or does he look like a jovial guy who you don't think is a threat when you see this kind of big lumbering guy?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the, you know, fact that we have perspective that this is mm-hmm. likely the Zodiac killer. But look, I've been in those situations where you have a big dude who may not look like, you know, he's a bodybuilder, but he's a big guy. Who I call it is, these are people who are just naturally powerful people. They're naturally right. strong, maybe never lifted a weight in their life, but they could, you know, lift my patrol car over if they got mad enough, you know, just because they're naturally powerful people. So I was always, I was always in that position of, you know what, if this person really wants to overpower me, they probably can, unless I take some really, really good, you know, some good officer safety tactics here. So I would find him, you know, as someone laying out at a lakeside or being approached, I would find that intimidating just from his okay. size when you look at him. I would.
Yep. No, that's my question. Yeah, that's yeah. my question. One thing before we go back in time, so right around this time, or April of 1970, there was a letter with a cipher where supposedly the killer put his name in the cipher, and I don't know that that one's ever been broken.
Yeah.
I think that one might still. So who knows if that's even really legitimate or if that's just nonsense characters or whatever. But mm-hmm. Something to add there. So at this point in time, the documentary kind of takes a step back and goes to earlier crimes that took place in California and, you know, kind of questions or draws a connection to the Zodiac. And the first one is June of 1963. Two high school kids, Linda Edwards and Bobby Domingos, killed at a beach near Lompoc. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where it gets interesting. And I'm going to try to be very specific about this because I noticed something here in the documentary that, again, you know, as I always say, Mark, there's a narrative in these documentaries. So they're not necessarily going to present the information that doesn't support their narrative very clearly. It might be there if you extract it, but they're not going to put it on the front page. Mm-hmm. And what they said was Arthur Lee Allen had taken two of the Seawater kids to the beach that day. And I'm assuming that's Connie and David.
Yeah.
Could have been also one of the younger brothers. I don't know. Takes them to the beach, parks the car on the side of the road, and tells them to wait in the car. He gets something. Now, before there, he had stopped at a PX in mm-hmm. Vandenberg Air Force Base, I think, PX.
Because he was a Navy veteran.
Navy veteran.
And
stops at Vandenberg. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Stops at Vandenberg PX, buys something. The kids describe how it's packaged, like cardboard box with almost like metal corners on it. And the thought being that it's ammunition, mm-hmm. that it's boxes of shells. Puts it in the trunk of the car. He drives the kids to the beach and he tells the kids, wait in the car. And he gets out and goes down to the beach. And according to them, he's gone about an hour. They do get out of the car because they're rambunctious kids, whatever. They don't go down to the beach, but they're playing on the railroad tracks. They're playing around. And they say about an hour later, he comes back to the car. And right, Mark, he has blood on him or something red on him?
Yes, he has blood on him, on his hands, arms. And he, if I remember correctly, you know, he's kind of he's a little bit in a hurry at that point to get going.
Looked like he was maybe flustered or in a rush. I think throw something in the trunk of the car. And I want to say Connie, the daughter, even went to him and tried to help him clean his, said she tried to help him clean his arms or his hand or whatever was cut. And he was like, don't worry about it. Get in the car. And they take off. Now, they did not say in the documentary the specific date that this this journey or this trip with the kids happened. But we know that there was a murder there June 4th, 1963. There was a double murder down on the beach. A gun was used. There was a little like beach shack, and I guess the bodies were taken in a beach shack. And if something, if I'm off base here, Mark, let me know, but shot, tied up, whatever, I don't know, kind of a similar to maybe what we saw in the other murders, in that it was a man and a woman alone in an isolated area. That much is the same. So, you know, the documentary is making it look like, no, the kids remember that this, they went to the beach. Now, the, you know, this documentary, I don't know when it was filmed, but within the past, let's say 5 years, likely.
I think it was more recent than that, yeah.
Yeah, so but they're remember, you know, are we to believe they're remembering a specific date they went on this trip in 1963 is my question. Right. Because they did not say that we remember it was this date, we went here, and then, oh my gosh, these murder happens. What they said was, man, it dawned on us that these places where we went ended up being places where the Zodiac struck.
Correct.
Did you take that differently, or did you see a direct connection where they really said, like, no, this is the date we were there. We remember this is the date we were there. And then there was this double murder at that location on that day.
No, I, what you said formally, it appeared to me that after they saw the movie and you know, like I said, from 2017, that they started now, this refreshed their memory about places they had been with Alan. And they start tying these things together that, oh, we were in that same place, that same area, about the same time, you know, these murders took place. And then with that, they start, you know, these other things, the ciphers, the misspelling, the diving outfit, they start putting all these things together. So yeah, that's, they didn't have a clear memory of the date, you know, by itself. It was part of a mosaic that, you know, they're, with their memory being refreshed from seeing this movie, they start going back and kind of re-examining. So the 2007, Vince, thank you, was actually 2007 was that movie. With
the, right, the one with Jake Gyllenhaal Robert Downey Jr. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, which is a fantastic movie, by the way. So, yeah, that's how I took it as well. This is how I took it as well, Bill, that they didn't. Now, by the way, there wasn't one exception. We'll probably get into the Riverside murder, yes. I believe.
Yep.
And that's a little bit different because they have some things there can actually nail down specific dates. But go ahead.
Now, one thing about this, or a couple things about this beach killing. And again, you know, as you're watching this documentary, my initial thought was, wow, that is strong circumstantial evidence that the kids were there with him that day. And this double murder took place, but that's not what was, you might draw that conclusion from the documentary, but that's not what was actually said. I want to make that clear. What was actually said is we realized that we had been places with this guy and those places were in the area of crime scenes, you know, of Zodiac crime scenes.
Yes.
One thing about those killings on the beach, and I'm looking at it right now, the killer did use Winchester Western Super X ammunition, the same ammunition used by the Zodiac during the 68 murders on Lake Herman Road. So one of the ones we already talked about.
Correct. And I can't remember, maybe you can help me, Bill, but not only that, did he find that at multiple crime scenes, they also found that same ammunition. I can't remember what was in his trailer.
At his house. Yeah. Somewhere where they did a search. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. They found that specific type, brand, and of course caliber of ammunition basically in his purview, in his possession.
Right. And you know, this, as far as an MO, this murder had similarities to the murder at Lake Berryessa, the one where he wore the costume, in that they think he confronted these people, got their cooperation to tie them up, but man, he ended up shooting. The only thing I've heard that's somewhat different about this case, he shot one 11 times, the other 9 times. And the thought was, what did he have a rifle? So there was some speculation that because of the number of shots, that likely a rifle was used in this crime, as opposed to the other crimes with the .22. It was a pistol, or there was thought that it was a pistol. But I don't think there's really any, there's nothing scientific to support that, other than just, you know, the number of shots and someone saying, hey, that's more rounds than a typical pistol holds. It must have been a rifle with a tube magazine or whatever, some type of magazine that would hold 20 rounds.
Yeah.
So I don't know that the next murder, and you kind of alluded to it, was the Riverside one, right?
Yeah.
And that was, I got to look and see, Mark, what year that was, because that was,
I believe
that one there is one of the more interesting. October 30th, 1966.
Six. Very good.
So 3 years after this Santa Barbara Beach killing, 2 years before some of the Berryessa killing, the golf course killing, the lake killing that we talked about when we started. And what happened here was, Arthur Lee Allen goes to Connie Seawater and says, I'm sorry, goes to Phyllis Seawater, the mom, and says he would like to take Connie down to Riverside, California, to some kind of auto race. He had been someone that went to like a race
driving
car
school.
Driving school. There you go. Mm-hmm. And because of that, he had like pit access passes and all this stuff. The mom thinks about it, and I don't know if the brother David gets involved, but the decision is made that they don't want Connie going alone with Arthur Lee Allen to Riverside, mm-hmm. but the two of them can go. The brother David can go with Connie, and they go with him. So
yeah, I think it was David, the one that was outspoken about, hey, I don't want her going by. Now, again, in the documentary, at this point, David had already begun to suspect that Allen had his eyes set on his sister. And if I remember correctly, in the documentary.
Yeah, and in like a predatory way. Like, yes he was concerned. I'd agree with that. Uh-huh. I'd agree with that. So they go down to Riverside. Now, this one, there is a little more specific information mm-hmm. where they remember, and I think you alluded to that earlier, where they remember the specific dates. And I think that revolves around the mom wanting them home for Halloween on the 31st.
Exactly. There's two reasons. Right. One, okay. it's because of the Halloween date, and second, it's because of the date of the car race. In other right. words, that's it's memorialized, and so that helped him really piece those things together in conjunction with the murder that we're going to talk about in a minute.
And the other part of it that corroborates this one is Arthur Lee Allen pointed out a specific car and said that's Steve McQueen driving yes. that car. And there was video of Steve McQueen at this event driving, you know, a Ford Cobra or whatever it was at this event. Mm-hmm. Two things significant about this, Mark. I don't know if you want to talk about the drugging of the kids or the, you know, what happened with that. So they go to the car races for the whole day. They go back and get a hotel room. And if I'm not mistaken, the next morning, Arthur Lee Allen wakes up the girl Connie, and the son David still asleep. He yeah. is knocked out.
And, quite literally, we think.
Yeah, literally knocked out. And had been, both of them had been, I guess, knocked out the night before. And that's possibly when Arthur Lee Allen took advantage of this, went out and murdered, what was her name? Sherry Jo Bates.
Bates, uh-huh.
And I guess let's talk about that murder before we get back to the drugging of the kids. Mm-hmm. This was at the Riverside Community College Library. And Sherry's car was parked outside and somebody had disabled it, pulled wires off the distributor or did something so the car wouldn't start. And then as she's out there trying to get the car started, the murderer comes over as a good Samaritan and says, hey, you know, can I give you a ride somewhere? It looks like your car won't start. Can I give you a ride? And she walks away with him. And as they're walking away, he says something to the effect like, you know, I guess now's a good time or something like that. And she says, now's a good time for what? And then he murders her. Mm-hmm. So the thing about this murder was, and I don't know if it's misdirection or what it is, there was a letter that went to the police department about this murder. And something in the letter said like, you know, this was for ignoring me or for not giving me the time of day or something for a long period of time. And that made the local police feel like it was a jilted lover situation. And they didn't really want to focus on Arthur Allen. They thought it was this other boyfriend. Later, they found DNA evidence or something that actually excluded him, excluded the suspect that they had. But I don't know if this was more of not literal, but more figurative. Like, I did this murder because people like you wouldn't give me the time of day. There was like a frustration with not being able to develop a relationship with a woman or something like that. And that caused him to do this murder. But whatever the case, there was, you know, the Zodiac did write letters about this murder. Right. And, you know, either the Zodiac did it or he took credit for it just to mess with the police. But there's strong evidence that he was down there because of what the Seawater kids say and evidence that he did it. So now back to the drugging of the kids.
Now, by the way, Bill, just let me interject here.
Yeah.
Now, according to Connie, and again, we take all this with a grain of salt, but if she is accurate in her recollection of this, you know, this general time frame with the Riverside trip, she says that the day before the murder that, because they got down there, they were down there for a couple of days, that Allen took her for a tour of the Riverside City College campus.
Oh, that's right.
Which is really significant. In other words, he's going out and he's doing recon and things like this. Again, if what she's saying is accurate, this would be another huge, huge, you know, indication that it's likely that he is the Zodiac killer, certainly the suspect in this particular murder.
That's right. And there was the reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Okay, so a letter was sent to the LA Times confirming that this was a Zodiac killer. And he said in the Zodiac wrote, I do have to give them credit for stumbling across my Riverside activity, but they are only finding the easy ones. There are a hell of a lot more down there. Interesting, right?
Very.
Very interesting that he's taking credit for this. So he had given the kids some type of drug. And I don't know, with Connie, I think it was in orange juice or something in the morning.
Yes.
But whatever the fact, some point during this two-day trip or couple-day trip, he had drugged each of the kids.
Yes.
He later tells Connie that basically he almost admits to both of them, to David and to Connie, that he molested Connie. Am I right about that, Mark?
That's correct. Now she says that at some point while they're on the campus of Riverside Community College, that he put his hand down, you know, in her, it touched her genitals or down her pants or
correct.
Something like that.
And
then at some point she believes that while she was knocked out along with her brother David, he actually fully, you know, that fully, whatever the word, molestation, but he additionally molested her while they were in the motel room.
Right. So that is a strange one. So, I mean, they're all, I shouldn't say it like that. They're all strange, but, you know, drugging the kids and whatever. So I don't know, Mark, I think the next thing that kind of happens is this 2007 movie comes out or you know what about the fact that these Zodiac murders stopped for a period of time and yes. What had happened at that time? So because we should talk about that, right?
Yes. So eventually he was arrested, and you can fill the gaps in, but he was arrested for child molestation.
Yep.
Alan was, and then he was committed to the state mental hospital for a period of years. And of course, while he was confined, the murders stopped.
Yep.
And you know, again, it's one more piece of that puzzle that, you know, that points to this man, but I forget what the years were.
I think it was around 74.
Probably.
I'm looking right now. I mean, there's a lot of irony there. First was that he was in the same, he was sent to the same mental hospital as
the father,
the children's husband.
Yeah.
For the same crime. For the children's father.
Mm-hmm.
Sent to the same hospital as the children's father for the same type of crime that the children's father had committed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while he was in there, like you said, there's no assaults. He writes letters to Phyllis, the mom, and she's under the impression that it's just some crime of violence that, mm-hmm. that he was convicted of.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of deception going on. And I think,
because this is what he had told the mother.
Right.
I forget exactly what it was, but he certainly didn't reveal the truth behind his incarceration. So he kept her in the dark. And quite frankly, I mean, it's very apparent that she didn't want to know the truth anyway and really kind of denied reality, and I think until the day she died.
Right. So, you know, an interesting thing is... When the movie comes out, and we kind of alluded to this, when the movie comes out in 2007, the kids see this movie, and to them, because Arthur Allen was a suspect, the police felt that he was the only viable suspect for this crime. They had interviewed him at this point. They had done a search warrant, which I skipped ahead of, Mark, and I don't know if you have details of the search warrants, multiple search warrants that were done. He was the only named suspect in the case, but he wasn't charged, and they didn't believe it. Then they saw this movie, which was not a documentary, in 2007, but, you know, followed the case, you know, pretty accurately, I guess. And they thought, wow, all these places where these murders happened, Arthur Allen had taken us there.
Yes.
Anything else about like the search warrants and the police?
Yeah, the search warrants, I believe it was the initial one. Again, they didn't find anything, at least, you know, at that point. Like you said, today with DNA and things like this, they probably almost certainly would have found something to tie a particular suspect to a particular crime. But at the time, they didn't have the technology. But what they did find were... they found in his refrigerator, freezer, whatever it is, they found multiple pieces, I believe, Bill, of animals, you know, stored inside their freezer. They found other types of, you know, terribly graphic material, satanic material, things like this in the searches. Obviously, a lot of suspicious stuff, but nothing that would concretely tie him to a crime scene. But again, it goes to really the mental depravity, the state of mind of Alan. So again, it's something again that doesn't really exclude him from anything. That's not enough to get a conviction. But boy, right. It sure raises suspicions about his responsibility and involvement.
One of the other strongest pieces of evidence for me, and again, it's circumstantial, but Connie Seawater had, you know, the young girl who he molested and went on, you know, some of these trips with him. She moves to New York. She gets married. She has a child of her own. And it sounds like Arthur Lee Allen is not happy about that, right? He doesn't like the fact that she left. He says he's going to come out to New York and get her and bring her back to California. And about this time, there's what's referred to as the Albany letter. And it's a letter that's sent to, let me see where it was sent to. The Albany Times Union newspaper receives this letter. And in this letter, there's a cipher. And he says he's naming his next victim in the cipher. And he also says Albany's a nice place. Now, Connie lived near Albany, New York. This cipher is fed into a supercomputer, and I don't know exactly when this was, but this is, you know, in the past 10 years anyway, probably. Yeah. And they were able to crack this cipher, and the name they get is Connie Henley as the next victim. Now, this isn't the kids saying this. This isn't, this is just a computer cracking that cipher and saying in this letter written by the Zodiac, it says the next victim is going to be Connie Henley. So they do, law enforcement tries to find someone named Connie Henley. They can't do it. They can't make any association to any murders or anything else. Here's the reality. Phyllis Seawater, her maiden name is Hensley. And we already talked about the propensity that Alan had for making spelling mistakes. Right? Mm-hmm. Purposeful spelling mistakes. And so we know who Connie is. Would he use Connie with Connie's mom's maiden name, Hensley, spell it as Henley, and say, this is my next victim? And was he going to kill her because he was, angry that she moved away and she was married now to this guy and he wanted her for himself? Is that strong circumstantial evidence to you? Like, where do you put that? Or do you think that's just some random thing and it doesn't have a relation?
No, actually, there are a few pieces of incredibly strong circumstantial evidence. But this, to me, Bill, it probably stands alone to me as the most impactful, important piece, because you made the point that this was a computer.
Right.
It's objective. And it broke this code. It comes up with a name that is clearly tied to the mother of these children's maiden name. It is misspelled, probably on purpose, that ties into all the other ciphers that we deal with when it comes to Alan. To me, it's almost irrefutable that at least this line goes from him to Connie, when she's in Albany, and if that's the case, then it would be almost a direct nexus to all of those other ciphers. If that's the case, then it would be irrefutable that this is the same person who committed these murders going back as early as 1963. That's where I come up with it. Again, it's one of the two. I think it's the most important piece of this puzzle altogether, all by itself. Yep. This is the most important piece. When you combine this, and again, we didn't get the dates clear here, but not only did the murder stop when he was committed to the psychiatric hospital, so did the correspondence to the publications, to law enforcement. Right. And that's because everything that goes out of the hospital is reviewable by the staff. They get to read everything that goes out or comes in. So he couldn't sit, even if he wanted to keep taunting them from the facility, he couldn't, because the staff reads all of the information. So this is, it's just, to me, it's almost undeniable that he was the man that is responsible for the Zodiac killings.
Yep, I agree. And even in that letter, that Albany letter that we talked about, he said, I'm not dead and I'm not in the hospital, which would be a strange thing to say, right? Right.
Yeah.
Well, he had been in a mental hospital. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
Two more quick things, Mark. The first is the son of Connie Seawater also had some kind of relationship with Arthur Allen, because, again, he was, a friend of the family at this point, et cetera. And they were driving around in his car. I'll zip through this. They get a flat tire. They're changing the tire. And in the trunk of the car is a knife wrapped in plastic tape. And Arthur Allen tells him, hey, keep it. You can keep it. So the son keeps it. And later on, when they make these realizations about Arthur Allen, they turn that that knife over to law enforcement or whatever, and there's DNA testing done, and they find that on the handle of the knife, there's three different contributors of DNA, and on the blade of the knife, there's two different contributors of DNA. Now, I don't think they do have Arthur Allen's DNA. They I guess they took a sample of his brain matter when he died, but at the time this this documentary was released, they hadn't done the testing to establish that yet. Or again, as we see in documentaries, if it didn't fit the narrative, they might have skipped over it. But there is a knife that was found in his car that had blood on it. I guess they did that through presumptive testing. They found there was blood on the knife, and they have DNA fragments on it from multiple people. So
now, Bill, I know you wanted to ask a question, and I wanted to chime in before you asked the question.
Yeah.
Let's just stop right there.
Uh-huh.
They found a knife in his vehicle. Well, the knife came from his vehicle.
Uh-huh.
With human blood on it. Again, they haven't been able to match the DNA to a particular person or people, things like that, but it is definitively human blood. How many of us have a knife in our vehicle or possession that has any human blood on it? Now, again, is it possible you cut yourself? I've cut my finger so many times in the garage, you know, blah, 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 whatever. I get it. But the likelihood that you have a knife, and by I think there's a pretty good load of blood on there too, that has human blood, and not get this, of course, it's not just human blood, it's at least from three different people. Mm-hmm. If we were able to say this is one person, oh, well, it's his own blood. It's his own blood. Yep. He cut himself, you know, gutting a fish, cutting a chicken in his car, you know, and Barry Essip, you know, things like this. But this is from three different sources, contributors on this one knife. So with that said, go ahead and finish your question. I just wanted to stop right there and have people think about this clearly. Yep. How many of us would have a knife in our vehicle or in our possession, any place, that has three different sources of human beings on that one tool?
That's strong evidence. That's strong evidence, Mark. The only other thing I wanted to bring up with this was when Connie Seawater died. I mean, listen, Connie, you know, the kids went to Connie after the 2007 movie when they had this realization and they told the mom about what had happened, about the fact that he had drugged them, the fact that he molested them, the fact that they thought he was a Zodiac, and the mom really didn't want to hear it, Mark. Correct. And a lot of that goes to, you know, I guess maybe her, a lot of that could go to, let me put it that way, her guilt, her denial of inviting this man around her children and around her family when he was a predator. And it's easier for her to just not believe that narrative than to say, oh my God, how did I let this guy around my kids and my household, right?
Now, by the way, this is Phyllis, not Connie. No, Connie's
daughter. I'm sorry, Phyllis. Yeah, I'm sorry, Phyllis. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Phyllis.
No, by the way, I had to look at the name straight myself, so yeah.
Yeah, so she dies, I think 2017, and after she dies, then Connie, the daughter, and the son David, and the other son go through her stuff, and they find all these correspondence with Alan from when he was in the mental hospital, mm-hmm. and just other times, and he talks about, you know, they almost got me to confess once. You know, is that something that someone who's not guilty of a crime says? They almost got me to confess once. I don't think so, Mark. And he talks about, he had a videotape of all these excerpts of news stories about the Zodiac and about him. And it's almost, you know, I don't know. Did that seem like the collection of memorabilia from someone who was being falsely accused or falsely prosecuted? Or did it seem like the collection of a demented person keeping, as we often hear, like we heard that from Gil Carrillo too, keeping like some mementos of their crimes or something like that?
Yeah, I think it speaks for itself, Bill. I think you laid it out really well, kind of with the question that, you know, who would do this if you were... if you were not responsible for these murders, it's just the kind of behavior that, that, you know, anybody out there listening right now, that if you'd have been accused of these murders, is this the kind of correspondence that you would engage in if you were innocent, if you were not guilty, if you had nothing to do with these? And the answer is obviously no. Now, would a deranged person who's not responsible, you know, could they go down that road, which just happened? Yeah, that's possible. But there's obviously something wrong with this person to correspond, you know, with this woman in the way that he did, if he's not responsible or is otherwise not seriously, seriously mentally ill. The other thing I want to say about Phyllis, the mother here, you brought up the, you really, Bill, and I'm glad you brought this great point up a while back about the irony of Alan being confined in the same mental institution that Phyllis's ex-husband did for the same offenses. And that's involving, obviously, the inappropriate interaction with minors. We'll put it that way.
Yep.
And this, again, this is a little bit ancillary, but it's important. You have to wonder how much that she may have been in denial with her ex-husband's behavior.
Yes.
And if there's something that makes her vulnerable to... Yep. Or attractive to other individuals with the same tendencies.
Yep.
And that maybe Alan sensed or saw this the same way that her ex-husband did. And then, like you said, going to her deathbed, probably realizing that not just this time with Alan, but previously with her husband, that she had certainly allowed,
facilitated,
if not had encouraged, facilitated. Yep. It's a really, really sad, I say ancillary, it certainly has a lot of overlap, but ancillary story to this murder story.
Yeah, I come away with this, Mark, to wrap it up, thinking that Arthur Lee Allen was the Zodiac Killer. I realize there's some disagreement about what crimes were actually committed by the Zodiac Killer, but I have no doubt that Arthur Lee Allen committed some of them, at least. And hey, that's based on this documentary, but also based on independent research and looking at some of the people out there who tried to exclude him as a suspect and some of the things that they said that just don't resonate with me. I feel like he was the guy. Do I think there'll ever be any official closure of this case? Probably not. I mean, even if we see the DNA come back on the knife, I don't know that we have DNA from the victims of these crimes, you know, from the 60s to match it to. So it would be real difficult to do. Your feelings, do you think Arthur Lee Allen is the guy, Mark?
Yeah, listen, not being on a jury, not being sworn, you know, under oath and things like this, about as far as I can, beyond a reasonable doubt, as we sit here, I don't see anything of substance that would exclude him from at least some of these murders. And I'll finish with this from my point, for my part, Bill, is that in addition to that, I would bet any amount of money that, of course, a number of unsolved murders out there are also his responsibility.
I agree with that, too. Folks, let us know in the comments, is Arthur Lee Allen, the Zodiac Killer, the only suspect named by police over the years? Do you think he's the one that did it? And what crimes do you think are actually attributable to him? And maybe what crimes you think should be excluded from that that Zodiac portfolio? Thanks for listening, folks. We'll catch you next time on Truth Nation. Thank you.